We're going to be in Mark chapter 5 this morning. The disciples had headed out on the boat. You remember last week, and they faced the storm, and Jesus had calmed the sea, and they are painfully aware that that the one that they are sailing with and traveling with is none other than God himself. And so let's pick up the story there. We're in Mark chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. They came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. And Jesus got out of the boat, and immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had been dwelling among the tombs, and no one had been able to bind him even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart and the shackles broken to pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, night and day, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains and gashing himself with stones. Seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and he bowed down before him, and shouting with a loud voice, he said, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me." For he had been saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit," and was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he began to implore him earnestly not to send them out into the country, out of the country. Now there was a large herd of swine feeding thereby in the mountains. The demons implored him, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." And Jesus gave them permission. And coming out of the unclean spirits, and coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them. Can you imagine how much that would have stunk? Before and after, actually. And they were drowned in the sea. Their herdsmen ran away and reported in the city and in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed, sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion, and they became frightened. And those who had seen it described to them how it happened to the demon-possessed man and about all of the swine, and they began to implore Jesus to leave their region. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him, and he did not let him. But he said to him, "Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and he began to proclaim in the Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. You know what? I forgot my... Forget is the name of the game. So Joe's about to bring me the little clicker thing. But have you ever wondered if you were too far gone for Jesus? If you were beyond what he could reach you? And, you know, sometimes we think, "Oh, well, nobody's unreachable." Thank you, sir. We think nobody's unreachable. But really, I think that is... you know, that's years of Christian thinking that's made us feel that way, because all of us have felt unreachable at times. You know, Jesus has gone to the other side. Now, the other side, we just think of it as a location thing, but really, in the ancient world, the Jews would talk about going to the other side, like we might talk about going to the other side of the tracks or the wrong side of town. You know, it was not just a location, but it was a kind of place. Going to the other side of the lake was to go to an evil place, it was the place of the Gentiles. In fact, you see at the end of this that it's referred to as the Decapolis, which just means 10 cities, but they were 10 cities of the Gentiles, and it was an unclean place, a place where Jews didn't go, and the Jews were disgusted not only by the place but by the people who lived there, and that's probably the real reason. But you notice that they have this huge herd of pigs, which is really not a big thing for Jews. They don't really like that very much. So Jesus comes, And he comes to the other side. He is unafraid of enemy territory. He's unafraid of the unclean, both the people and the pigs and the whole thing. He's not afraid of sinful people or sinful places. He's not afraid of Satan himself. And so when Jesus comes and he sets his foot on the shore, the forces of evil recoil at his presence. That's probably, it, you know, every time I work on a sermon, there's one thing that stands out to me, and this one is probably not that profound to anybody, but the whole, that when Jesus' foot hits the shore, everybody knows it in the evil world, in the demonic world. So anyway, as soon as Jesus' foot hits the shore, he's met by this guy who is the talk of the town. We call him the Gerasene demoniac. He lives among the tombs. He's naked. And to say that he's naked is to say that it's shameful. You know, he's the kind of guy that everybody goes, oh, he walks through our town. There was this guy whenever we lived in Nowata. He wore a dress everywhere and he walked around town. He'd been in an accident and he was kind of out of his mind, but. You know, whenever you'd bring visitors to town or something, you'd be sitting at the Pizza Hut and this guy would go walking by and you just got to go, well, there's our Gerasene demoniac. But anyway, so he was this shameful person in town. He lived among the tombs. And a couple of things about living among the tombs, you know, number one, for the Jews, this would be a terribly unclean thing because you're among the dead. And touching the dead or touching anything that's touching the dead or being around things that are dead, all of those things make you unclean, and it's just not the place you want to be. We wouldn't want to hang out there either, right? But and the tombs are not like the tombs that we have modern day where you bury somebody and you put the little plaque on there that you can mow over. It's not like that at all. It's not even like the ones that used to have the headstone, but it's more like you know, it's a cave that you enter in, or you know, a man-made cave that you enter in, and they actually bring the bodies in and put them there. Well, one of the reasons that somebody would live among the tombs is that in pagan cultures they would actually bring food to the dead. So, and the food would be gone, and so they'd think the dead people ate it. But actually, it was these people. The poor would live among the tombs because there was food there. So the poorest of the poor and the mentally ill and, in this case, a demoniac, actually live there on the outskirts of society. This guy is out of control. Society has tried to control him. They tried to control him with chains and shackles, but he has overcome all of those means of restraint. And it's kind of like somebody in, you know, who's on drugs and is so strong and unable to be restrained. But this demon who is in him has caused a sort of madness in him. And I've heard, and to even talk about that kind of raises the whole question of demons. And I hear people talk about, you know, demons no longer possess people. So, you know, some people are in that camp. They just think that they just don't exist anymore. And other people are in the camp that kind of sees a demon behind every bush. I remember back when I was in high school, there was a guy named Frank Peretti who was writing all kinds of books. And in these books, everything that was bad was the result of some demon. You know, if your car didn't start, it was a demon with a sword in the engine of your car, you know, ridiculous stuff. C.S. Lewis writes, this is an incredible quote at the beginning of his great book, Screwtape Letters. He wrote, there are two equal, and let me not do it from memory. There are two errors into which our race can fall regarding the devils. One is to disbelieve their existence. The other is to believe and show an unhealthy interest. They themselves are equally pleased with both errors. In our enlightenment mindset, we don't want to believe in demons. Instead, we would rather say everything is a medical issue or a psychological issue, a chemical issue, whatever. But the problem is that demons really do exist. And even though people might want to think that Scripture just reflects kind of a pre-scientific mindset where they attributed everything to demons, Jesus doesn't cast out mental illness here. He casts out demons. Demons are real. They do possess people. And I think demonic possession was probably more common in Jesus' day than it is today, simply because, you know, there are moments in history where things like this seem to surge, and Jesus' presence in the world, I think, brought that out. But I think it has the same effect. Well, I mean, I think the reason that it's so prevalent then is the same reason that whenever Jesus sets his foot on the shore, the demons come out. It's because the presence of God brings it out. But I think it would be naive to say that demons do not exist or do not possess people today. It's arrogance to say that they're just a figment of primitive imagination, or however we might see this. But what we've done is we've renamed our demons, and now we don't exorcise them at all. And I mean like get them out, you know, that kind of exorcising them. Demons are spiritual beings who are agents of Satan in the world. We see in Scripture they can speak, they can torment people, they can influence people, they can possess people. And while I can't personally attest to a whole lot of demonic possession, I've seen it in small parts, and I've certainly seen their influence. I think that the main way we see it today is through their influence, because demons, by their very nature, want to work undercover. They're, coming out in the open is not what they want to do. So let's turn our attention to what we can see with our eyes, not just these imaginative things in the world, but what we can see, the work of Satan in the world. Satan has certainly had his way with mankind in the world. You can look at our world, our culture, our society, and see that. You can look at the sensuality and the drugs and the acceptance of immorality and the lying and the cheating, and we look at all of that sin and we don't think anything about it, and it has possessed us as a society. Society stopped even doing anything about it. I mean, for a while we tried to slap some chains on it. You know, we talked about family values, and we had motivational speakers, and we used fear tactics, and we tried all of that stuff, but sin like just cast that stuff off like it's nothing. All our human efforts have been fruitless in that way. And so finally it seems like we've just resolved to let sin live among us, and we're okay with that. And we just take the people who've engaged in sin too much, and we just kind of turn them out in the tombs. And we let them run out there while we, who manage our sin better, you know, hang out in the rest of the world. And so, you know, we give our kids condoms and we say, be safe. And we don't want them to drink and drive, so we serve them booze at home. And, you know, the drug problem gets higher and higher, and so we give out free needles. And, you know, what we've done is we've just kind of turned everything out, and we said, we're just going to manage our sin somehow. I think we've been completely overtaken. But you know, it's easy to talk about society, right? We don't have to look that far. I mean, Satan's had influence in our own lives. You know, that we become so desensitized that we are not even moved by sin anymore. Sometimes we sin expecting forgiveness. We think righteousness is a convenience. You know, it's what we do when we want to do, and it's what we do when there's nothing better to do. We gossip. We backbite. We lie. We do those things sometimes without even thinking about it. You know, Satan's had his influence here. And it's not like we haven't tried to our best to stop it. You know, we slap chains on it. We try whatever we can to break the habit. But eventually, it casts the chains off. We're unable to stop it. And so we just turn our head to sin and we go out and live in the tombs. We just relegate it to a part of our lives that we don't talk about very much. And so we hide our sin and we continue to practice it. We excuse ourselves because we figure, hey, everybody has a vice, right? So mine happens to be, and you fill in the blank. And we get angry at people who would suggest that our sin is actually evil, don't we? You know, oh, you can't say that about me. I mean, for one thing, we've resolved in ourselves, nothing can be done about our sin. So for somebody to suggest that it's evil just makes us angry. But then there's Jesus. And he has set his foot on the shore of our country. And when Jesus got off the boat, this demoniac comes running up to him. And he bows down to him. And look at verse 6. It says, seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and he bowed down before him and shouted with a loud voice, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God to not torment me." He comes bowing. Why do you suppose this demon-filled man would come and bow? Is it submission that he's submitting to Jesus or some kind of honor that he's giving him? I don't think so. I think what he's doing is begging. In verse 8 it says, because Jesus had been saying, "Come out of him." I think he's begging. I think the demons don't want to come out. And so they're scrambling for whatever excuse they can have to stay and to not do what Jesus said. So now, as a side note, I don't know if you noticed this or you thought about this, but as you read this, these demons are having this conversation with Jesus. And they're having this conversation because Jesus has tried to cast them out multiple times and they're not leaving. So, you think evil's difficult to deal with? It is, you know. So these demons accuse Jesus of being out of his territory. They say, "You don't belong here, Jesus. What do we have to do with you? This is our area, the Decapolis. This is where we live. You can't come here and just tell us what to do. We reign here. You should be on the other side over there with the Jews. You deal with them, that's fine. This isn't where you belong." And then they call him by his rightful name. They say, "You are the Son of the Most High God." As a side note, Jesus doesn't want them to say that. He doesn't want this testimony from these guys. But it's an interesting thing that the ones who would know identify him as the Son of God. But the reason that they do that is probably just a power play. In the ancient world, they believed, and we'll see this here in just a second with Jesus as well, that if you knew somebody's true identity, it gave you power. Like when your mother calls you by your middle name. You know, she knows it's some special power that she has over your soul. And so they're thinking, if they come to Jesus and they say, "I know who you really are," that somehow that gives them some leverage with Jesus. And then they implore him in the name of God. You know, it doesn't sound like the devil to invoke the name of God, but he does because he knows where the power is and he knows how God ticks, and so that's how he does it. So sin has a reaction to Jesus coming. And whenever Jesus sets his foot on our shore and we encounter the righteousness of Jesus, we want to say things like, "Who are you to judge me? You know, you created me this way. You don't have any right to say this. This is my life. Go away. You don't belong here. I reign here." When Jesus puts his foot on the shore, it changes everything. You know, I mean, listen to your own heart. When it comes to your sin, how do you speak? What does it say? You know, you say, whenever somebody talks to you about sin, something inside you says, "Look, you don't have any business talking to me about sin. You got stuff in your own life. Go away. I have good reason for my sin. You know, I know why I'm doing what I'm doing, and you don't. So butt out." We get angry when our sin is exposed. And if somebody were to name our sin, you know, greed or prejudice or lust or adultery or pride, it just makes us angry. Don't say that. And Jesus does that everywhere he goes. Every time he sets his foot on the shore, it disturbs the evil in that place. Evil is not safe in the presence of Jesus. Never is it safe in the presence of Jesus. Look at verse 9. Jesus was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he began to implore him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now, Jesus asks for the name of the demon, but he's kind of playing their own game. But notice that the demon does not give him his name. He says, "We're Legion. There's so many of us. We're not telling you our names because we know we're smart. We know that if we give you our name, you have control of us." Well, Jesus isn't bound by that kind of silliness. He has absolute and objective and authority over all things. And even in this country, even in this evil, even over these demons that refuse to give their name, and they say they are Legion, which Legion was a Roman term for how they divided up their army. It meant about 6,000 soldiers. So they're just saying, "Hey, we're many, we're big, we're big stuff. You can't just push us around." And then as they're talking, you know, as they say this, they know the authority in Jesus, and so you kind of see them start out, you know, "We're Legion," and they go, "Please don't send us out of the country." They know who they're dealing with. They know their ultimate fate is that they are going to be cast out into the abyss. They're going to be judged. And so whenever they say, "Don't send us out of the country," that's what they're talking about. They're saying, "Don't send us home. You know, this is where we belong. This is where we are." And so they, so look at verse 11. It says, "Now there was a large herd of swine feeding nearby on the mountains, and the demons implored him, saying, 'Send us into the swine, so that we may enter them.'" These swine are symbols of uncleanness, of evil. And the demons want to, they're just begging for a host. "Let us go into these pigs, because they're evil anyway. Let us hook up with them. And at least give us room in these pigs." And Jesus gave them permission. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. Now, I don't understand why Jesus complied with their request. Do you? I don't get that. I don't get it. Perhaps it was some sort of divine humor. I actually kind of see maybe that's it. You know, they wanted a host, so Jesus gives them this unclean evil host, and even this unclean evil group of beasts, which that's how the Jews viewed pigs, is that they couldn't handle these demons in them. And so they ran off and would rather kill themselves than have this demonic host. Maybe it was a picture of greater cleansing, that God is not just going to cleanse this one person, and he's not just going to cleanse Israel. Maybe he's going to cleanse all people, that he sends it into these, that he's going to rid the world of these demons. I don't know. I don't know why Jesus does that. But the demons leave the man, and they possess these pigs, and the pigs run off into the sea. Now, one thing about this, just a side note, the symbolism of them going into the sea is the same as sending them into the abyss, as sending them into the, they saw the sea as this dangerous place, this picture of Hades and all that stuff. But anyway, but one thing is clear, and that is that Jesus is Lord even here. He is Lord even in enemy territory. And it didn't matter a bit that Jesus was in the far country. Didn't matter a bit that he was on the other side. He would engage the enemy and is victorious over it. The land that thought it was beyond the reach of God, he reached it. You know, the land that the Jews thought was beyond the reach of God, he went there. The land where sin was so pervasive and people would think that God would have nothing to do with them because they didn't want anything to do with God. He went there. Jesus is Lord everywhere. Everywhere. He claimed this ground that had formerly been Satan's ground. He claimed it for God. You know, I feel a little bit that way about Oregon. You know, you listen to people talk about Oregon. People, Christians from here, you know, they say, oh man, this is the other side. You know, so few people here go to church. And so, you know, that this is a place where Satan has a hold. And, you know, what I want to say to that is, Jesus is Lord, even here. This is not a place that God has not reached and is not reaching. I mean, you and I are part of that. I mean, we are a part of God's movement here. But, you know, even more than a place, though, sometimes I feel like I'm the far country, the other side. I don't know. You know, it's easier to talk about places. But if that place is me, that's a little harder. You know, have you ever felt like, hey, I'm unreachable? The sin that's in me is destroying me. You know, it makes me unclean. It makes it, you know, sometimes you feel like I'm hopeless without, and God doesn't want anything to do with me. It's common. And it's common even among Christians. So, but Jesus is the answer, and he has actually come behind enemy lines to save you. And he will free you from the sin that enslaves you. He'll give you the ability to choose him. You know, whenever you, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but whenever you are without Christ, you don't actually have the choice to choose. You know, evil is all around you, and that's the only choice that you have. Jesus is the one who gives us the freedom to choose to follow Christ, to choose to follow God, to choose righteousness. He gives us that power to choose. All right, so the scene changes, verse 14. The herdsmen ran away and reported in the city and in the country that the people had come to see, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed. He was sitting down, clothed in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion, and they became frightened. You know, the herdsmen were worried because these pigs were their responsibility. And when these pigs go off the cliff, they're going to lose their job. That's all there is to it. But more than that, they might lose their lives. And so they go to the townspeople, and kind of their idea is that we're going to stir up these people. We're going to give them all of the information. We're going to stir them up, and then maybe they'll come out and at least defend them. So the townspeople come out, and they're curious to see what's happened. And they come up, and they see this man who they all know has been just absolutely crazy in the tombs. And he's sitting there in his right mind, and he's dressed, and he's sitting at the feet of Jesus. He's a disciple. And they're frightened. They're frightened. He's listening to Jesus teach, and these people, they say, those who had seen it described to them and how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all the swine, they became frightened, it says. You know, they focus on the swine. Well, have you ever had that experience where you've known somebody who was so convinced of Jesus and their faith was so strong that it was intimidating to you? I think that's what happens is they come here and there's this good thing that's happening. But what they do, verse 16, is those who had seen it, they start worrying about the swine. And they began to implore Jesus to leave the region because ultimately, even though they've seen this guy's life changed, what they really care about is what happened to the pigs. What happened to this business that we had running? You know, they've seen the power of God, but they don't want anything to do with it. And so they ask Jesus to leave. And, you know, that's not so foreign to us. You know, whenever we see somebody whose life makes us look not as good, we're ready for them to leave. We really don't want them to be around. You know, I'm kind of happy with my sin. And you think that this guy who's so on fire about Jesus, you think, well, one of these days he's going to learn, and he'll become lackadaisical in his life with Christ, just like I did. Because remember, it costs us greatly to follow Jesus. It costs these guys a bunch of pigs. If they want to follow Christ, then they've got to deal with the fact that Jesus sent their pigs down this cliff. It's not easy. Verse 18. Jesus, now understand what they do is they say, Jesus, get out of here. We don't even want you here anymore. So they ask Jesus to leave. Now, you think about that for a second, that they have just asked the Son of God, the hope of the world, to leave their place. A little scary. So as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him. And he didn't let him, but he said to him, "Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim it in the Decapolis, what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed. This man realizes he's living in a hostile situation. And so he comes to Jesus and says, "Hey, take me with you. Get me out of here." And Jesus' answer is, "No, you go back. You live loudly in this world where you live, in this place where you live. You go back and you be light in that darkness. You go back and you tell people what's happened." And this former demoniac goes back to the place where he lives, to all of these people who know what kind of a person he was, and he proclaims Jesus to them. And it changes the world. And he goes back, and this is a sower who goes in to sow, and some of it falls on good ground, and some of it produces 100-fold. This is the seed, and the soil is this new land, the Decapolis. We have been changed. We who have been changed have as our mission to take the light of God to this world where we live. You know, we might want to kind of run away and be with Christ and be someplace that's safe. And some people have this theology that says, "Just beam me up, Scotty." But it doesn't work that way. Jesus sent us to be a part of the world that we live. And we're not called out of the darkness and into the light just to kind of hang out in the light. We're called to be injected back into the darkness and to be the light to the world. We at Singing Hills, we have that mission. That all of us have people around us, work co-workers and family, friends who don't know Christ, who desperately need to hear about His light and the way that He's changed us. They need to hear the gospel of Christ. We have a mission, not just to our family and friends, but to the whole surrounding area. You know, in Hillsborough and Beaverton and Aloha and Forest Grove and all of these, Portland, the list goes on and on. We live and work and travel in all of these different places. And we have this responsibility to take to these dark places the light of Christ. That's what He sent us to do. We are that light. So, that's what we're called to. But all of us may not be there right now. So the question is, whenever you read a story like this, when I read a story like this, is, you know, where am I in this story? You know, am I like this demoniac full of demons, engaged with evil, and, you know, my mind is out of control, and whenever I look inside, am I legion? Is that who I am? Or am I the herdsman that I'm scared that following Christ, or that Christ is going to cost me a lot? You know, that I would go to the people around me and speak evil of what Jesus is doing. Is that who I am? Would I stir up people against Christ? Or am I the townspeople? Am I somebody who sees the good at what Christ has done and seeing what's good there and seeing what it'll cost me, say, "Hey, why don't you go talk to those people? Leave me alone." You know, we ask him to leave. You know, we've all been in those places. We've all worn the shoes of each of these people. We need hope. We need Jesus, whether we are the guy with Legion or the herdsman or the townspeople or whoever we are. We need the hope that only Jesus brings. When I look at the sin that used to define my life, lust and greed and selfishness, and gossip and hate and anger, and when I look at all that stuff, I realize that I should have answered, I am Legion. That's who I am. I was powerless to constrain this evil that was in me. And I realized that when Jesus called my name, that's what he called me. And then with a word, he cast out the demons inside me. And with a word, he forgave my sin and he changed me from somebody who was consumed with evil to being a disciple of Jesus. And that's the call to you this morning. You know, if you look at your life and you say, hey, I live on the other side. Jesus says to you, I came to you for you. He's setting his foot on your shore today. And he's calling you out. Let's stand. Heavenly Father, thank you for sending us Jesus, who is hope and life and light. And Father, may we be the kind of people that engage with him, and whether and that we would be changed by the powerful message that he brings us. In Jesus' name.